whilst Sir Creighton regaled her with his exploits on the Blackwater, where he had slain a dozen fearsome knights that she had never heard of. "Oh, it was a rare fight, my lady," he said, "a rare and bloody fray." He allowed that Sir Illifer had fought nobly in the battle as well. Illifer himself said little. When time came to resume their journey, the knights fell in on either side of her like guards protecting some great lady, though this lady dwarfed both of her protectors and was better armed and armoured in the nonce. "Did anyone pass by during your watches?" Brian asked them.
"Such as a maid of 3 and 10 with auburn hair," said Sir Illifer the Penniless. "No, my lady, no one."
"I had a few," Sir Creighton put in. "Some farm boy on a piebald horse went by, and an hour later half a dozen men afoot with staves and scythes. They caught sight of our fire and stopped for a long look at our horses, but I showed them a glimpse of my steel and told them to be along the way. Rough fellows, by the look of them, and desperate too, but ne'er so desperate as to trifle with Sir Creighton Longbow." No, Brian thought, not so desperate as that. She turned away to hide her smile. Thankfully, Sir Creighton was too intent on the tale of his epic battle with the Knight of the Red Chicken to make note of the maiden's mirth. It felt good to have companions on the road, even such companions as these two. It was midday when Brian heard chanting drifting through the bare brown trees. "What is that sound?" Sir Creighton asked. "Voices raised in prayer." Brian knew the chant. "They are beseeching the warrior for protection, asking the crone to light their way." Sir Illifer the Penniless bared his battered blade and reined in his horse to wait their coming. "They are close now." The chanting filled the woods like pious thunder, and suddenly the source of the sound appeared in the road ahead. A group of begging brothers led the way, scruffy, bearded men in rough-spun robes, some barefoot and some in sandals. Behind them marched 60 ragged men, women, and children, a spotted sow and several sheep. Several of the men had axes, and more had crude wooden clubs and cudgels. In their midst there rolled a 2-wheeled wain of grey and splintered wood, piled high with skulls and broken bits of bone. When they saw the hedge knights, the begging brothers halted and the chanting died away.
"Good knights," one said. "The mother loves you."
"And you, brother," said Sir Illifer. "Who are you?"
"Poor fellows," said a big man with an axe.
Despite the chill of the autumnal wood, he was shirtless, and on his breast was carved a 7-pointed star. Andal warriors had carved such stars in their flesh when first they crossed the narrow sea to overwhelm the kingdoms of the first men.
"We are marching to the city,"
said a tall woman in the traces of the wain, "to bring these holy bones to blessed Balor and seek succor and protection from the king."
"Join us, friends,"
urged a spare small man in a threadbare septon's robe who wore a crystal on a thong about his neck.
"Westeros has need of every sword."
"We were bound for Duskendale," declared Sir Creighton, "but mayhaps we could see you safely to King's Landing. If you have the coin to pay us for this escort," added Sir Illifer, who seemed practical as well as penniless.
"Sparrows need no gold," the septon said.
Sir Creighton was lost.
"Sparrows?
The sparrow is the humblest and most common of birds, as we are the humblest and most common of men."
The septon had a lean, sharp face and a short beard, grizzled grey and brown. His thin hair was pulled back and knotted behind his head, and his feet were bare and black, gnarled and hard as tree roots.
"These are the bones of holy men, murdered for their faith. They served the 7 even unto death. Some starved, some were tortured. Septs have been despoiled, maidens and mothers raped by godless men and demon worshippers. Even silent sisters have been molested. Our mother above cries out in her anguish. It is time for all anointed knights to forsake their worldly masters and defend our holy faith. Come with us to the city, if you love the Seven?"
"I love them well enough," said Ilifer, "yet I must eat."
"So must all the mother's children."
"We are bound for Duskendale," Sir Ilifer said flatly.
One of the begging brothers spat, and a woman gave a moan.
"You are false knights,"
said the big man with the star carved on his chest. Several others brandished their cudgels. The barefoot septon calmed them with a word.
"Judge not, for judgment is the father's. Let them pass in peace. They are poor fellows too, lost upon the earth."
Brain edged her mare forward.
"My sister is lost as well. A girl of 3 and 10 with auburn hair, fair to look upon."
"All the mother's children are fair to look upon. May the maiden watch over this poor girl, and you as well, I think."
The septon lifted one of the traces of the wain upon his shoulder and began to pull. The begging brothers took up the chant once more. Brian and the hedge knights sat upon their horses as the procession moved slowly past, following the rutted road toward Rosby. The sound of their chanting slowly dwindled away and died. Sir Creighton lifted one cheek off the saddle to scratch his arse.
What sort of man would slay a holy septon?
Brian knew what sort. Near Maidenpool, she recalled, the brave companions had strung a septon up by his heels from the limb of a tree and used his corpse for archery practice. She wondered if his bones were piled in that wain with all the rest.
"A man would need to be a fool to rape a silent sister," Sir Creighton was saying, "even to lay hands upon one. It's said they are the stranger's wives, and their female parts are cold and wet as ice."
He glanced at Brian.
Beg pardon."
Brian spurred her mare toward Duskendale. After a moment, Sir Ilifer followed, and Sir Creighton came, bringing up the rear. 3 hours later, they came upon another party struggling toward Duskendale, a merchant and his serving men, accompanied by yet another hedge knight. The merchant rode a dappled grey mare, whilst his servants took turns pulling his wagon. 4 laboured in the traces, as the other 2 walked beside the wheels, but when they heard the sound of horses, they formed up around the wagon with quarterstaffs of ash at the ready. The merchant produced a crossbow, the knight a blade.
"You will forgive me if I am suspicious," called the merchant, "but the times are troubled, and I have only good Sir Shadrick to defend me. Who are you?"
"Why," Sir Creighton said, affronted, "I am the famous Sir Creighton Longbow, fresh from battle on the Blackwater, and this is my companion, Sir Ilifer the Penniless."
"We mean you no harm," said Brian.
The merchant considered her doubtfully.
"My lady, you should be safe at home. Why do you wear such unnatural garb?"
"I am searching for my sister."
She dare not mention Sansa's name, with her accused of regicide.
"She is a high-born maid and beautiful, with blue eyes and auburn hair. Perhaps you saw her with a portly knight of 40 years or a drunken fool."
"The roads are full of drunken fools and despoiled maidens. As to portly knights, it is hard for any honest man to keep his belly round when so many lack for food. Though your Sir Creighton has not hungered, it would seem."
"I have big bones," Sir Creighton insisted. "Shall we ride together for a time? I do not doubt Sir Shadrick's valour, but he seems small, and 3 blades are better than 1.
4 blades, thought Brian, but she held her tongue.
The merchant looked to his escort.
"What say you, sir?"
"Oh, these 3 are naught to fear."
Sir Shadrick was a wiry, fox-faced man with a sharp nose and a shock of orange hair, mounted on a rangy chestnut courser. Though he could not have been more than 5'2", he had a cocksure manner.
"The one is old, t'other fat, and the big one is a woman. Let them come."
"As you say."
The merchant lowered his crossbow. As they resumed their journey, the hired knight dropped back and looked her up and down as if she were a side of good salt pork.
"You're a strapping, healthy wench, I'd say."
Sir Jamie's mockery had cut her deep. The little man's words hardly touched her.
A giant compared to some. He laughed. I am big enough where it counts, wench.
The merchant called you Shadrick.
Sir Shadrick of the Shady Glen. Some call me the Mad Mouse.
He turned his shield to show her his sigil, a large white mouse with fierce red eyes on bendy brown and blue. The brown is for the lands I've roamed, the blue for the rivers that I've crossed. The mouse is me.
And are you mad?
Oh, quite. Your common mouse will run from blood and battle. The mad mouse seeks them out.
It would seem he seldom finds them.
I find enough. 'Tis true, I am no tawny knight. I save my valour for the battlefield, woman.
Woman was marginally better than wench, she supposed.
You and good Sir Creighton have much in common, then.
Sir Shadrick laughed.
Oh, I doubt that, but it may be that you and I share a quest.
A little lost sister, is it, with blue eyes and auburn hair?
He laughed again. You are not the only hunter in the woods.
I seek for Sansa Stark as well.
Brienne kept her face a mask to hide her dismay.
Who is this Sansa Stark, and why do you seek her?
For love. Why else?
She furrowed her brow.
Love?
Aye, love of gold. Unlike your good Sir Creighton, I did fight upon the Blackwater, but on the losing side. My ransom ruined me. You know who Varys is, I trust?
The eunuch has offered a plump bag of gold for this girl you've never heard of.
I am not a greedy man. If some oversized wench would help me find this naughty child, I would split the spider's coin with her.
I thought you were in this merchant's hire.
Only so far as Duskendale. Hibbald is as niggardly as he is fearful, and he is very fearful.
What say you, wench?
I know no Sansa Stark, she insisted. I am searching for my sister, a highborn girl, with blue eyes and auburn hair.
Aye. Pray, who is this knight who travels with your sister?
Or did you name him Fool?
Sir Shadrick did not wait for her answer, which was good, since she had none.
A certain fool vanished from King's Landing the night King Joffrey died, a stout fellow with an ooze full of broken veins, one Sir Dontos the Red, formerly of Duskendale. I pray your sister and her drunken fool are not mistaken for the Stark girl and Sir Dontos.
That could be most unfortunate.
He put his heels into his courser and trotted on ahead. Even Jaime Lannister had seldom made Brienne feel such a fool.
You are not the only hunter in the woods.
The woman Brella had told her how Joffrey had stripped Sir Dontos of his spurs, how Lady Sansa begged Joffrey for his life.
He helped her flee.
Brienne had decided when she heard the tale.
Find Sir Dontos, and I will find Sansa.
She should have known there would be others who would see it too.
Some may even be less savory than Sir Shadrick.
She could only hope that Sir Dontos had hidden Sansa well.
But if so, how will I ever find her?
She hunched her shoulders down and rode on, frowning. Night was gathering by the time their party came upon the inn, a tall, timbered building that stood beside a river junction, astride an old stone bridge. That was the inn's name, Sir Creighton told them. The old stone bridge. The innkeep was a friend of his.
Not a bad cook, and the rooms have no more fleas than most, he vouched. Who's for a warm bed tonight?
Not us, unless your friend is giving them away, said Sir Illifer the Penniless. We have no coin for rooms.
I can pay for the three of us.
Brienne did not lack for coin. Jamie had seen to that. In her saddlebags, she'd found a purse, fat with silver stags and copper stars, a smaller one stuffed with golden dragons, and a parchment commanding all loyal subjects of the king to assist the bearer, Brienne of House Tarth, who was about his grace's business. It was signed in a childish hand by Tommen, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Roynard and the First Men, and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms. Hibbald was for stopping too, and bid his men to leave the wagon near the stables. Warm yellow light shone through the diamond-shaped panes of the inn's windows, and Brian heard a stallion trumpet at the scent of her mare. She was loosening the saddle when a boy came out of the stable door and said,
"Let me do that, sir."
"I am no sir," she told him, "but you may take the horse. See that she is fed and brushed and watered." The boy reddened.
"Beg pardons, my lady, a thought."
"It is a common mistake." Brain gave him the reins and followed the others into the inn, with her saddlebags across a shoulder and her bedroll tucked up beneath one arm. Sawdust covered the plank floor of the common room, and the air smelled of hops and smoke and meat. A roast was spitting and crackling over the fire, unattended for the moment. Six locals sat about a table, talking, but they broke off when the strangers entered. Brain could feel their eyes. Despite chainmail cloak and jerkin, she felt naked. When one man said,
"Have a look at that,"
she knew he was not speaking of Sir Shadrach. The innkeeper appeared, clutching three tankards in each hand and slopping ale at every step.
"Do you have rooms, good man?"
the merchant asked him.
"Aye, mate," the innkeeper said, "for them as has coin."
Sir Creighton Longbow looked offended.
"Nagle, is that how you would greet an old friend? 'Tis me, Longbow." "'Tis you indeed. You owe me seven stags. Show me some silver and I'll show you a bed."
The innkeep set the tankards down one by one, slopping more ale on the table in the process.
"I will pay for one room for myself and a second for my two companions."
Brain indicated Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer.
"I shall take a room as well," said the merchant, "for myself and good Sir Shadrach. My serving men will bed down in your stables, if it please you."
The innkeep looked them over.
"It don't please me, but might be I'll allow it. Will you be wanting supper? That's good goat on the spit, that is."
"I shall judge its goodness for myself," Hibbald announced. "My men will content themselves with bread and drippings."
And so they supped. Brain tried the goat herself after following the innkeep up the steps, pressing some coins into his hand and stashing her goods in the second room he showed her. She ordered goat for Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer as well, since they had shared their trout with her. The hedge knights and the septon washed down the meat with ale, but Brain drank a cup of goat's milk. She listened to the table talk, hoping against hope that she might hear something that would help her find Sansa.
"You come from King's Landing?" one of the locals asked Hibbald. "Is it true that the Kingslayer's been crippled?"
"True enough," Hibbald said. "He's lost his sword hand."
"Aye," Sir Creighton said. "Chewed off by a dire wolf, I hear. One of them monsters come down from the north. Nought that's good ever come from the north. Even their gods are queer."
"It was not a wolf,"
Brian heard herself say. "Sir Jamie lost his hand to a Cohorric sellsword."
"It is no easy thing to fight with your off hand," observed the Mad Mouse.
"Bah," said Sir Creighton Longbow. "As it happens, I fight as well with either hand."
"Oh, I have no doubt of that."
Sir Shadrach lifted his tankard in salute. Brain remembered her fight with Jamie Lannister in the woods. It had been all that she could do to keep his blade at bay. He was weak from his imprisonment and chained at the wrists. No knight in the Seven Kingdoms could have stood against him at his full strength, with no chains to hamper him. Jamie had done many wicked things, but the man could fight. His maiming had been monstrously cruel. It was one thing to slay a lion, another to hack his paw off and leave him broken and bewildered. Suddenly the common room was too loud to endure a moment longer. She muttered her good nights and took herself up to bed. The ceiling in her room was low. Entering with a taper in her hand, Brain had to duck or crack her head. The only furnishings were a bed, wide enough to sleep six, and the stub of a tallow candle on the sill. She lit it with the taper, barred the door, and hung her sword belt from a bedpost. Her scabbard was a plain thing,
wood wrapped in cracked brown leather, and her sword was plainer still. She had bought it in King's Landing to replace the blade the brave companions had stolen. Renly's sword. It still hurt, knowing she had lost it. But she had another longsword hidden in her bedroll. She sat on the bed and took it out. Gold glimmered yellow in the candlelight and rubies smoldered red. When she slid Oathkeeper from the ornate scabbard, Brain's breath caught in her throat. Black and red the ripples ran deep within the steel. Valyrian steel, spell-forged. It was a sword fit for a hero. When she was small, her nurse had filled her ears with tales of valor, regaling her with the noble exploits of Sir Galadon of Morn, Florian the Fool, Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, and other champions. Each man bore a famous sword, and surely Oathkeeper belonged in their company, even if she herself did not. "You'll be defending Ned Stark's daughter with Ned Stark's own steel," Jaime had promised. Kneeling between the bed and wall, she held the blade and said a silent prayer to the crone, whose golden lamp showed men the way through life. "Lead me," she prayed. "Light the way before me. Show me the path that leads to Sansa." She had failed Renly, had failed Lady Catelyn. She must not fail Jaime. He trusted me with his sword. He trusted me with his honor. Afterward, she stretched out on the bed as best she could. For all its width, it was not long enough, so Brienne lay across it sideways. She could hear the clatter of tankards from below and voices drifting up the steps. The fleas that Longbow had spoken of put in their appearance. Scratching helped keep her awake. She heard Hibbled mount the stairs, and sometime later the knight as well. "I never knew his name," Sir Creighton was saying as he went by, but upon his shield he bore a blood-red chicken, and his blade was dripping gore. His voice faded, and somewhere up above, a door opened and closed. Her candle burned out. Darkness settled over the old stone bridge, and the inn grew so still that she could hear the murmur of the river. Only then did Brienne rise to gather up her things. She eased the door open, listened, made her way barefoot down the steps. Outside, she donned her boots and hurried to the stables to saddle her bay mare, asking a silent pardon of Sir Creighton and Sir Illifer as she mounted. One of Hibbled's serving men woke when she rode past him, but made no move to stop her. Her mare's hooves rang upon the old stone bridge. Then the trees closed in around her, black as pitch and full of ghosts and memories. "I am coming for you, Lady Sansa," she thought, as she rode into the darkness. "Be not afraid. I shall not rest until I've found you."
Eddard. The visitors poured through the castle gates in a river of gold and silver and polished steel, 300 strong, a pride of bannermen and knights, of sworn swords and free riders. Over their heads, a dozen golden banners whipped back and forth in the northern wind, emblazoned with the crown stag of Baratheon. Ned knew many of the riders. There came Sir Jaime Lannister, with hair as bright as beaten gold, and there Sandor Clegane, with his terrible burned face. The tall boy beside him could only be the crown prince, and that stunted little man behind them was surely the imp, Tyrion Lannister. Yet the huge man at the head of the column, flanked by two knights in snow-white cloaks of the King's Guard, seemed almost a stranger to Ned, until he vaulted off the back of his warhorse with a familiar roar and crushed him in a bone-crunching hug. "Ned! Ha ha! But it's good to see that frozen face of yours." The King looked him over from top to bottom and laughed. "You've not changed at all." Would that Ned had been able to say the same. 15 years passed when they had ridden forth to win a throne. The Lord of Storm's End had been a clean-shaven, clear-eyed, and muscled like a maiden's fantasy. 6.5 feet tall, he towered over lesser men, and when he'd donned his armour and the great antlered helmet of his house, he became a veritable giant. He had a giant's strength, too. His weapon of choice, a spiked iron war hammer that Ned could scarcely lift. In those days, the smell of leather and blood had clung to him like perfume. Now it was perfume that clung to him like perfume, and he had a girth to match his height. Ned had last seen the king 9 years before, during Balon Greyjoy's rebellion, when the stag and the dire wolf joined to end the pretensions of the self-proclaimed King of the Iron Islands. Since the night they had stood side by side in Greyjoy's fallen stronghold, where Robert had accepted the rebel lord's surrender, and Ned had taken his son Theon as hostage and ward, the king had gained at least 8 stone. A beard as coarse and black as iron wire covered his jaw to hide his double chin and the sag of his royal jowls, but nothing could hide his stomach, or the dark circles under his eyes. Yet Robert was Ned's king now, not just a friend, so he said only, "Your Grace, Winterfell is yours." By then the others were dismounting as well, and grooms were coming forward for their mounts. Robert's queen, Cersei Lannister, entered on foot with her younger children. The wheelhouse in which they had ridden, a huge double-decked carriage of oiled oak and gilded metal, pulled by 40 heavy draft horses, was too wide to pass through the castle gate. Ned knelt in the snow to kiss the king's ring, while Robert embraced Catelyn like a long-lost sister. Then the children had been brought forward, introduced and approved of by both sides. No sooner had these formalities of greeting been completed than the king had said to his hosts, "Take me down to the crypt, Eddard. I would pay my respects." Ned loved him for that, for remembering her, still, after all these years. He called for a lantern. No other words were needed. The queen had begun to protest. They had been riding since dawn. Everyone was tired and cold. Surely they should refresh themselves first. The dead would wait. She had said no more than that. Robert had looked at her, and her twin brother Jamie had taken her quietly by the arm, and she had said no more. They went down to the crypt together, Ned and this king he scarcely recognized. The winding stone steps were narrow. Ned went first with the lantern. "I was starting to think we would never reach Winterfell," Robert complained as they descended. "In the south, the way they talk about my 7 kingdoms, a man forgets that your part is as big as the other 6 combined." "I trust you enjoyed your journey, Your Grace?" Robert snorted. "Bogs and forests and fields, and scarcely a decent inn north of the Neck. I've never seen such a vast emptiness. Where are all your people?" "Likely they were too shy to come out," Ned jested. He could feel the chill coming up the stairs, a cold breath from deep within the earth. Kings are a rare sight in the north. Robert snorted. "More likely they were hiding under the snow." "Snow, Ned!" The king put one hand on the wall to steady himself as they descended. "Late summer snows are common enough," Ned said. "I hope they did not trouble you. They are usually mild." "The others take your mild snows," Robert swore. "What will this place be like in winter, I shudder to think?" "Oh, the winters are hard," Ned admitted. "But the Starks will endure. They always have." "You need to come south," Robert told him. "You need a taste of summer before it flees. In Highgarden there are fields of golden roses that stretch away as far as the eye can see. The fruits are so ripe they explode in your mouth. Melons, peaches, fire plums, you've never tasted such sweetness. You'll see. I brought you some. Even at Storm's End, with that good wind off the bay, the days are so hot you can barely move. And you're to see the towns, Ned. Flowers everywhere. The market's bursting with food. The summer wine's so cheap and so good you can get drunk just breathing the air. Everyone is fat and drunk and rich." He laughed and slapped his own ample stomach a thump. "And the girls, Ned," he exclaimed, his eyes sparkling. "I swear the women lose all modesty in the heat. They swim naked in the river, right beneath the castle. Even in the streets it's too damned hot for wool or fur, so they go round in these short gowns. Silk, if they have the silver,
and cotton if not, but it's all the same when they start sweating, and the cloth sticks to their skin. They might as well be naked. The king laughed happily. Robert Baratheon had always been a man of huge appetites, a man who knew how to take his pleasures. That was not a charge anyone could lay at the door of Eddard Stark. Yet Ned could not help but notice that those pleasures were taking a toll on the king. Robert was breathing heavily by the time they reached the bottom of the stairs, his face red in the lantern light as they stepped out into the darkness of the crypt. "Your Grace," said Ned respectfully. He swept the lantern in a wide semicircle. Shadows moved and lurched. Flickering light touched the stones underfoot and brushed against a long procession of granite pillars that marched ahead, two by two into the dark. Between the pillars, the dead sat on their stone thrones against the walls, backs against the sepulchres that contained their mortal remains. "She is down at the end, with Father and Brandon." He led the way between the pillars, and Robert followed wordlessly, shivering in the subterranean chill. It was always cold down there. Their footsteps rang off the stones and echoed in the vault above as they walked among the dead of House Stark. The lords of Winterfell watched them pass. Their likenesses were carved into the stones that sealed the tombs. In long rows they sat, blind eyes, staring out into eternal darkness, while great stone direwolves curled round their feet. The shifting shadows made the stone figure seem to stir as the living passed by. By ancient custom, an iron longsword had been laid across the lap of each who had been Lord of Winterfell to keep the vengeful spirits in their crypts. The oldest had long ago rusted away to nothing, leaving only a few red stains where the metal had rested on stone. Ned wondered if that meant those ghosts were free to roam the castle now. He hoped not. The first lords of Winterfell had been men hard as the land they ruled. In the centuries before the Dragon Lords came over the sea, they had sworn allegiance to no man, styling themselves the kings in the north. Ned stopped at last and lifted the oil lantern. The crypt continued on into darkness ahead of them, but beyond this point, the tombs were empty and unsealed, black holes waiting for their dead, waiting for him and his children. Ned did not like to think on that. "Here," he told his king. Robert nodded silently, knelt, and bowed his head. There were three tombs, side by side. Lord Rickard Stark, Ned's father, had a long, stern face. The stonemason had known him well. He sat with quiet dignity, stone fingers holding tight to the sword across his lap. But in life, all swords had failed him. In two smaller sepulchres on either side were his children. Brandon had been 20 when he died, strangled by order of the Mad King Aerys Targaryen only a few short days before he was to wed Catelyn Tully of Riverrun. His father had been forced to watch him die. He was a true heir, the eldest, born to rule. Lyanna had only been 16, a child woman of surpassing loveliness. Ned had loved her with all his heart. Robert had loved her even more. She was to have been his bride. "She was more beautiful than that," the king said after a silence, his eyes lingering on Lyanna's face, as if he could will her back to life. Finally he rose, made awkward by his weight. "Ah, damn it, Ned. Did you have to bury her in a place like this?" His voice was hoarse with remembered grief. "She deserved more than darkness." "She was a Stark of Winterfell," Ned said quietly. "This is her place. She should be on a hill somewhere under a fruit tree, with the sun and clouds above her and the rain to wash her clean." "I was with her when she died," Ned reminded the king. "She wanted to come home, to rest beside Brandon and father." He could hear her still at times. "Promise me," she had cried, in a room that smelled of blood and roses. "Promise me, Ned." The fever had taken her strength, and her voice had been faint as a whisper,
but when he gave her his word, the fear had gone out of his sister's eyes. Ned remembered the way she had smiled then, how tightly her fingers had clutched his as she gave up her hold on life. The rose petals spilled from her palm, dead and black. After that, he remembered nothing. They had found him, still holding her body, silent with grief. The little Crannog man, Harlan Reed, had taken her hand from his. Ned could recall none of it. "I bring her flowers when I can," he said. Leanna was fond of flowers. The king touched her cheek, his fingers brushing across the rough stone as gently as if it were living flesh. "I vowed to kill Rhaegar for what he did to her."
"You did," Ned reminded him.
"Only once," Robert said bitterly.
They had come together at the ford of the Trident while the battle crashed around them. Robert with his war hammer and his great antlered helm, the Targaryen prince armoured all in black. On his breastplate was a three-headed dragon of his house, wrought all in rubies that flashed like fire in the sunlight. The waters of the Trident ran red around the hooves of their destriers as they circled and clashed, again and again, until at last a crushing blow from Robert's hammer stove in the dragon and the chest beneath it. When Ned had finally come on the scene, Rhaegar lay dead in the stream, while men of both armies scrambled in the swirling waters for rubies knocked free of his armour.
"In my dreams, I kill him every night," Robert admitted. "A thousand deaths will still be less than he deserves."
There was nothing Ned could say to that. After a quiet, he said, "We should return, Your Grace. Your wife will be waiting."
"The others take my wife," Robert muttered sourly. But he started back the way they had come, his footsteps falling heavily. "And if I hear Your Grace once more, I'll have your head on a spike. We are more to each other than that."
"I had not forgotten," Ned replied quietly. When the king did not answer, he said, "Tell me about John." Robert shook his head.
"I've never seen a man sicken so quickly. We gave her tourney on my son's name day. If you had seen John then, you would have sworn he would live forever. A fortnight later, he was dead. The sickness was like a fire in his gut. It burned right through him."
He paused beside a pillar before the tomb of a Londonderry Stark.
"I love that old man."
"We both did," Ned paused a moment. "Catelyn fears for her sister. How does Lysa bear her grief?" Robert's mouth gave a bitter twist.
"Not well, in truth," he admitted. "I think losing John has driven the woman mad, Ned. She has taken the boy back to the Eyrie. Against my wishes, I had hoped to foster him with Tywin Lannister at Casterly Rock. John had no brothers, no other sons. Was I supposed to leave him to be raised by women?"
Ned would sooner entrust a child to a pit viper than Lord Tywin, but he left his doubts unspoken. Some old wounds never truly heal, and bleed again at the slightest word. "The wife has lost the husband," he said carefully. "Perhaps a mother feared to lose a son. The boy is very young."
"Six, and sickly, and Lord of the Eyrie, God have mercy," the king swore. "Lord Tywin has never taken a ward before. Lysa ought to have been honoured. The Lannisters are a great and noble house. She refused to even hear of it. Then she left in the dead of night, without so much as a by your leave. Cersei was furious." He sighed deeply. "The boy is my namesake. Did you know that? Robert Arryn. I'm sworn to protect him. How can I do that if his mother steals him away?"
"I will take him as ward if you wish," Ned said. "Lysa should consent to that. She and Catelyn were close as girls, and she would be welcome here as well."
"A generous offer, my friend," the king said, "but too late. Lord Tywin has already given his consent. Fostering the boy elsewhere would be a grievous affront to him."
"I have more concern for my nephew's welfare than I do for Lannister pride," Ned declared.
"That is because you do not sleep with a Lannister," Robert laughed.
the sound rattling among the tombs and bouncing from the vaulted ceiling. His smile was a flash of white teeth in the thicket of the huge black beard.
"Ah," Ned said, "you're still too serious."
He put a massive arm around Ned's shoulders.
"I had planned to wait a few days to speak to you, but I see now there's no need for it. Come, walk with me."
They started back down between the pillars. Blind stone eyes seemed to follow them as they passed. The king kept his arm around Ned's shoulder.
"You must have wondered why I finally came north to Winterfell after so long."
Ned had his suspicions, but he did not give them voice. "For the joy of my company, surely," he said lightly. "And there is the wall. You need to see it, Your Grace, to walk along its battlements and talk to those who man it. The Night's Watch is a shadow of what it once was.
Benjen says..." "No doubt I will hear what your brother says soon enough," Robert said. "The wall has stood for what? 8,000 years? It can keep a few days more. I have more pressing concerns. These are difficult times. I need good men about me. Men like John Aaron. He served the Lord of the Eyrie, as Warden of the East, as the Hand of the King. He will not be easy to replace."
"His son," Ned began, "his son will succeed to the Eyrie and all its incomes," Robert said brusquely. "No more." That took Ned by surprise. He stopped, startled, and turned to look at his king. The words came unbidden. "The Aarons have always been Wardens of the East. The title goes with the domain."
"Perhaps when he comes of age, the honour can be restored to him," Robert said. "I have this year to think of, and next. A six-year-old boy is no war leader, Ned."
"In peace, the title is only an honour. Let the boy keep it, for his father's sake, if not his own. Surely you owe John that much for his service." The king was not pleased. He took his arm from around Ned's shoulders.
"John's service was a duty he owed his liege lord. I'm not ungrateful, Ned. You of all men ought to know that. But the son is not the father. A mere boy cannot hold the East."
Then his tone softened.
"Enough of this. There is more important office to discuss, and I would not argue with you."
Robert grasped Ned by the elbow.
"I have need of you, Ned."
"I am yours to command, Your Grace, always." They were words he had to say, and so he said them, apprehensive about what might come next. Robert scarcely seemed to hear him.
"Those years we spent in the Eyrie, gods, they were good years. I want you at my side again, Ned. I want you down in King's Landing, not up here at the end of the world, where you're no damn use to anybody."
Robert looked into the darkness, for a moment as melancholy as a stark.
"I swear to you, sitting a throne is 1,000 times harder than winning one. Law's a tedious business, and counting copies is worse, and the people, there's no end of 'em. I sit on that damnable iron chair and listen to them complain until my mind is numb and my ass is raw. They all want something, money or land or justice. The lies they tell. And my lord and ladies are no better. I'm surrounded by flatterers and fools. It can drive a man to madness, Ned. Half of them don't dare tell me the truth, and the other half can't find it. There are nights I wish we had lost at the Trident. No, not truly, but..."
"I understand," Ned said softly. Robert looked at him.
"I think you do. If so, you're the only one, my old friend." He smiled. "Lord Eddard Stark, I would name you the Hand of the King."
Ned dropped to one knee. The offer did not surprise him. What other reason could Robert have for coming so far? The Hand of the King was the second most powerful man in the Seven Kingdoms. He spoke with the king's voice, commanded the king's armies, drafted the king's laws. At times he even sat upon the Iron Throne to dispense king's justice when the king was absent or sick or otherwise indisposed. Robert was offering him a responsibility as large as the realm itself. It was the last thing in the world he wanted. "Your Grace," he said, "I am not worthy of the honour." Robert groaned with good-humoured impatience.
"If I wanted to honour you, I'd let you retire. I'm planning to make you run the kingdom, and fight the wars while I eat and drink and wench myself into an early grave. He slapped his gut and grinned. You know the saying about the king and his hand?
Ned knew the saying. What the king dreams, he said, the hand builds.
I bedded a fish maid once who told me that the low-born have a choicer way to put it. The king eats, they say, and the hand takes the shit. He threw back his head and roared with laughter. The echoes rang through the darkness, and all around them the dead of Winterfell seemed to watch with cold and disapproving eyes. Finally, the laughter dwindled and stopped. Ned was still on one knee, his eyes upraised.
"Damn it, Ned," the king complained. "You might at least humour me with a smile."
They say it grows so cold up here in winter that a man's laughter freezes in his throat and chokes him to death, Ned said evenly. Perhaps that is why the Starks have so little humour.
"Come south with me, and I'll teach you how to laugh again," the king promised. "You help me win this damnable throne, now help me hold it. We were meant to rule together. If Lyanna had lived, we should have been brothers, bound by blood as well as affection. Well, it is not too late. I have a son, you have a daughter, eh? My Joff and your Sansa shall join our houses, as Lyanna and I might once have done."
This offer did surprise him. Sansa is only 11. Robert waved an impatient hand.
"Old enough for betrothal. The marriage can wait a few years," the king smiled. "Now stand up and say yes, curse you."
"Nothing would give me greater pleasure, Your Grace," Ned answered. He hesitated. "These honours are all so unexpected. May I have some time to consider? I need to tell my wife."
"Yes, yes, of course. Tell Catelyn. Sleep on it if you must."
The king reached down, clasped Ned by the hand, and pulled him roughly to his feet.
"Just don't keep me waiting too long. I'm not the most patient of men."
For a moment, Eddard Stark was filled with a terrible sense of foreboding. This was his place, here in the north. He looked at the stone figures all around him, breathed deep in the chill silence of the crypt. He could feel the eyes of the dead. They were all listening, he knew. And winter was coming.
He was right about the end of the day's contests. By the time the chaos had been set to rights, the sun was low in the west, and Lord Ashford had called a halt. As the shadows of evening crept across the meadow, 100 torches were lit along the merchant's row. Dunk bought a horn of ale for himself and half a horn for the boy to cheer him. They wandered for a time, listening to a sprightly air on pipes and drums and watching a puppet show about Nymeria, the warrior queen with the 10,000 ships. The puppeteers had only 2 ships, but managed a rousing sea battle all the same. Dunk wanted to ask the girl Tanzel if she had finished painting his shield, but he could see that she was busy. "I'll wait until she is done for the night," he resolved. "Perhaps she'll have a thirst then."
"Sir Duncan!" a voice called behind him, and then again, "Sir Duncan!" Suddenly Dunk remembered that was him. "I saw you among the small folk today, with this boy on your shoulders," said Raymond Fossaway as he came up, smiling. "Indeed, the two of you were hard to miss."
"The boy is my squire. Egg, this is Raymond Fossaway."
Dunk had to pull the boy forward, and even then Egg lowered his head and stared at Raymond's boots as he mumbled a greeting.
"Well met, lad," Raymond said easily. "Sir Duncan, why not watch from the viewing gallery? All knights are welcome there."
Dunk was at ease among small folk and servants. The idea of claiming a place among the lords, ladies, and landed knights made him uncomfortable.
"I would not have wanted any closer view of that last tilt."
Raymond grimaced.
"Nor I. Lord Ashford declared Sir Humphrey the victor and awarded him Prince Arian's courser, but even so,
He will not be able to continue. His leg was broken in two places. Prince Baylis sent his own maester to tend him.
Will there be another champion in Sir Humphrey's place?
Lord Ashford had a mind to grant the place to Lord Caron, or perhaps the other Sir Humphrey, the one who gave Harding such a splendid match. But Prince Baylor told him that it would not be seemly to remove Sir Humphrey's shield and pavilion under the circumstances. I believe they will continue with four champions in place of five.
Four champions, Dunk thought. Leo Tyrell, Lionel Baratheon, Tybalt Lannister, and Prince Velar.
He had seen enough this first day to know how little chance he would stand against the first three, which left only...
A hedge knight cannot challenge a prince. Velar is second in line to the Iron Throne. He is Baylor Breakspear's son, and his blood is the blood of Aegon the Conqueror, and the young dragon, and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight. And I am some boy the old man found behind a pot shop in Fleabottom.
His head hurt just thinking about it.
Who does your cousin mean to challenge?
He asked Raymond.
Sir Tybalt, all things being equal. They are well matched. My cousin keeps a sharp watch on every tilt, though. Should any man be wounded on the morrow, or show signs of exhaustion or weakness, Stefan will be quick to knock on his shield, you may count on it. No one has ever accused him of an excess of chivalry.
He laughed, as if to take the sting from his words.
Sir Duncan, will you join me for a cup of wine?
I have a matter I must attend to,
said Dunk, uncomfortable with the notion of accepting hospitality he could not return.
I could wait here and bring your shield when the puppet show is over, sir,
said Egg.
They're going to do Simeon Star Eyes later and make the dragon fight again as well.
There, you see, your matter is attended to, and the wine awaits,
said Raymond.
It's an Arbor vintage, too. How can you refuse me?
Bereft of excuses, Dunk had no choice but to follow, leaving Egg at the puppet show. The apple of House Fossaway flew above the gold-colored pavilion where Raymond attended his cousin. Behind it, two servants were basting a goat with honey and herbs over a small cook fire.
There's food as well if you're hungry,
Raymond said negligently as he held the flap for Dunk. A brazier of coals lit the interior and made the air pleasantly warm. Raymond filled two cups with wine.
They say Arion is in a rage at Lord Ashford for awarding his charger to Sir Humphrey, he commented as he poured. But I'll wager it was his uncle who counseled it.
He handed Dunk a wine cup.
Prince Baylor is an honorable man.
As the Bright Prince is not, Raymond laughed. Don't look so anxious, Sir Duncan. There's none here but us. It is no secret that Arion is a bad piece of work. Thank the gods he is well down in the order of succession.
You truly believe he meant to kill the horse?
Is there any doubt of it? If Prince Maker had been here, it would have gone differently, I promise you. Arion is all smiles and chivalry so long as his father is watching, if the tales be true, but when he's not.
I saw that Prince Maker's chair was empty.
He's left Ashford to search for his sons, along with Roland Craighall of the Kingsguard. There's a wild tale of robber knights going about, but I'll wager the prince is just off drunk again.
The wine was fine and fruity, as good a cup as he had ever tasted. He rolled it in his mouth, swallowed, and said,
Which prince is this now?
Maker's heir, Darren. He's named after the king. They call him Darren the Drunken, though not in his father's hearing. The youngest boy was with him as well. They left Summerhall together, but never reached Ashford.
Raymond drained his cup and set it aside.
Poor Maker.
Poor,
said Dunk, startled.
The king's son?
The king's fourth son, said Raymond. Not quite as bold as Prince Baylor, nor as clever as Prince Ares, nor as gentle as Prince Rachel. And now he must suffer seeing his own sons overshadowed by his brothers. Darren is a sot. Arion is vain and cruel,
The third son was so unpromising they gave him to the citadel to make a maester of him. And the youngest?
Sir Duncan!
Egg burst in, panting. His hood had fallen back, and the light from the brazier shone in his big dark eyes.
You have to run! He's hurting her!
Dunk lurched to his feet, confused.
Hurting? Who? Arian!
The boy shouted.
He's hurting her! The puppet girl, hurry!
Whirling, he darted back out into the night. Dunk made to follow, but Raymond caught his arm.
Sir Duncan!
Arian, he said.
Prince of the Blood, be careful.
It was good counsel, he knew. The old man would have said the same, but he could not listen. He wrenched free of Raymond's hand and shouldered his way out of the pavilion. He could hear shouting off in the direction of the merchant's row. Egg was almost out of sight. Dunk ran after him. His legs were long and the boy's short. He quickly closed the distance. A wall of watchers had gathered around the puppeteers. Dunk shouldered through them, ignoring their curses. A man-at-arms in the royal livery stepped up to block him. Dunk put a big hand on his chest and shoved, sending the man flailing backward to sprawl on his ass in the dirt. The puppeteer's stall had been knocked on its side. The fat Dornish woman was on the ground weeping. One man-at-arms was dangling the puppets of Florian and Jonquil from his hands as another set them afire with a torch. Three more men were opening chests, spilling more puppets on the ground and stamping on them. The dragon puppet was scattered all about them, a broken wing here, its head there, its tail in three pieces. And in the midst of it all stood Prince Arian, resplendent in a red velvet doublet with long, dagged sleeves, twisting Tenzel's arm in both hands. She was on her knees, pleading with him. Arian ignored her. He forced open her hand and seized one of her fingers. Dunk stood there stupidly, not quite believing what he saw. Then he heard a crack, and Tenzel screamed. One of Arian's men tried to grab him and went flying. Three long strides and Dunk grabbed the prince's shoulder and wrenched him around hard. His sword and dagger were forgotten, along with everything the old man had ever taught him. His fist knocked Arian off his feet, and the toe of his boot slammed into the prince's belly. When Arian went for his knife, Dunk stepped on his wrist and then kicked him again right in the mouth. He might have kicked him to death right then and there, but the princeling's men swarmed over him. He had a man on each arm and another pounding him across the back. No sooner had he wrestled free of one than two more were on him. Finally, they shoved him down and pinned his arms and legs. Arian was on his feet again. The prince's mouth was bloody. He pushed inside it with a finger.
You have loosened one of my teeth, he complained. So we'll start by breaking all of yours.
He pushed his hair from his eyes.
You look familiar.
You took me for a stable boy.
Arian smiled redly.
I recall. You refused to take my horse. Why did you throw your life away? For this whore?
Tenzel was curled up on the ground, cradling her maimed hand. He gave her a shove with the toe of his boot.
She's scarcely worth it. A traitor? The dragon ought never lose.
He is mad, thought Dunk. But he is still a prince's son, and he means to kill me.
He might have prayed then, if he had known a prayer all the way through, but there was no time. There was hardly even time to be afraid.
Nothing more to say, said Arian. You bore me, sir.
He poked at his bloody mouth again.
Get a hammer and break all his teeth out, wait, he commanded. And then let's cut him open and show him the color of his entrails.
No!
A boy's voice said.
Don't hurt him!
Gods be good, the boy, the brave, foolish boy, Dunk thought. He fought against the arms restraining him, but it was no good.
Hold your tongue, you stupid boy! Run away! They'll hurt you! No, they won't!
Egg moved closer.
If they do, they'll answer to my father, and my uncle as well. Let go of him, I said. Wait, Yorkel, you know me! Do as I say!
The hands holding his left arm were gone, and then the others. Dunk did not understand what was happening. The men-at-arms were backing away. One even knelt. Then the crowd parted for Raymond Fossaway. He had donned mail and helm, and his hand was on his sword.
His cousin, Sir Stefan, just behind him, had already bared his blade, and with them were a half-dozen men-at-arms with the red apple badge sewn on their breasts. Prince Arion paid them no mind.
"Impudent little wench," he said to Egg, spitting him out.